President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Welcome to the show on this September the 22nd, still on the West Coast, now the 23rd on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We have a great show for you this evening. Before I introduce tonight's guest, a couple of quick announcements. First of all, I've had a lot of people asking about some of the more current archives. If you're in a hurry to listen to archives, I suggest you subscribe, if you haven't already, to BBS Radio's archives. For a nominal fee for a period of 1 year, you can download any show on the whole network. And it's a bargain and a half. It's actually a much better deal than what I hear is out there with many of the other shows that just offer one particular archive. If you are impatient and you can't wait for me to get something posted up on my site, which I like to do with a little description so you can read a little bit about it and decide if you want to listen or not, then I suggest you subscribe to the BBS Archives, which is a good thing to do anyway. It keeps BBS on the air, and it keeps all these wonderful shows streamed into your homes or wherever your computer might happen to be. These days, there's even people listening to the shows on cell phones using or their Wi-Fi devices, Blackberries, whatever. That said, there are a couple of things that I would like to point out. Number one, our economy is crashing pretty much across the board. We've been talking about this issue on Evident Footprints for a good year and a half. And we've also been talking about this, or I should say I have, on many shows that I've been on as a guest. And when I pointed out all the corruption that was going on with the central banks, with the Federal Reserve, which is no more federal than Federal Express, people were in disbelief, and that's understandable because this is a belief system, this matrix that we're entrapped in. And then all of a sudden people started realizing, wait a minute, the economy's pretty messed up. Oil was up to $150 a barrel, and it's making a climb again. It jumped yesterday $16 a barrel, and they always have some reason for this happening, although there is no oil crisis, there is no energy crisis, if that's going to be our standard method of fueling automobiles and jets and buses and trucks and everything else. There are other technologies available to us, but they have to nickel and dime us to death. And they're charging us for everything, and of course, we're taxed to death. Everything we buy is a tax. And there's some kind of a tax attached to it. They're talking about restructuring the income tax so that people who have been getting away without paying taxes for years because they're in this special corporate percentile that year after year after year has every loophole available to them. Now and the smaller people have been bearing the burden. And a lot of that is carried into everyday living when you make purchases, the sales taxes you have and all of the fees that go along with buying a home or buying a car, and then the property taxes. And it's just one thing after another. You're taxed when you die. You're taxed when you go to the bathroom. It's that ridiculous. And now we're witnessing the collapse of the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac mortgage scam is what it is, because all along This money was never really lent out. It was lent out on paper, and if you fail to pay, they take over the property. So basically, you're just funding a secret private organization. And in a future show, very soon, I'm going to be talking about this organization that nobody really knows about. Few people do, but by and large, nobody does. And I'm not speaking about the Federal Reserve. And I'll be talking about that on a future show. You will be amazed at how much money is taken in and how much all the banking system is under the control of one private bank. And this bank is in New York. That said, now they're getting ready to put another $700 billion. And, of course, this is what's coming out in the media supposedly bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they're going to give it to a bank. It'll probably end up either with J.P. Morgan or Morgan Stanley, possibly Bank of America. And while this is going on, Citibank is holding something like $19 trillion of money that's come in to make settlement payments under Wantagate, which is all about money laundering. And theft and corruption. And these are all computer transactions. The money's actually not moving from one place to another except on a computer screen. And within a tenth of a second, someone can make billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. And this is all being stolen from us. And you're not going to hear that, although now the media is talking about, well, now we have to really push this through Congress, the $700 billion. And I'm going to tell you that likely the money has been stolen and they're getting caught. So now they have to put another tax on us. We should be up in arms about this. You should be calling all of your local, state, and federal representatives and voicing extreme displeasure with what's going on, because this is nothing more than more organized crime. And they're selling our country out from underneath us. Now, hopefully by tomorrow, part four of the Three Stooges Go to Washington, the part about Barack Obama, will be published on my website and will be coming out next month in the Idaho Observer, but we should have it up tomorrow. And I know, based on the number of people that have read the article on my website within the past week, I know many, many people are going to be wanting to read this. And I deal with all the issues, all the stuff that the mainstream media is not reporting. That's what I've reported. And you're going to see the truth about what's going on, and you're going to see how it fits into what's going on today. And I don't mean campaigns. I'm talking about the topic that I just brought up, the corruption and the money laundering. You're going to see it. So that said, we are going to now move on to tonight's guest, and hopefully we're going to take some calls. I'm going to ask the listening audience that would like to ask tonight's guest a question to call in to the BBS Station 2 numbers, and I'll give a couple of those out. Toll-free in the USA and Canada, 888-228-4494. Also, worldwide, toll-free, 877-489-6350. Of course, you got to put a one in front of that, and we'll stick to those two numbers right now. Probably the bottom half of the hour, we'll be taking some calls if you've got some questions or you want to make some comments for tonight's guest. Tonight's guest is a doctor. He has successfully run a hospital in the state of Tennessee. He's going to tell you briefly about how this hospital basically was just taken from him and stolen by the powers that be, and all this over a drug called OxyContin. And OxyContin has been in the news. He has become a whistleblower regarding this issue, and he is also credited as being the creator of the addiction model. And we're going to be talking about that, as well as the people in government who are behind this thing. With that, I'd like to welcome again to Evident Footprints my now good friend, Dr. Richard Norton. Richard,
hey,
how
Don,
are you this evening?
Good, Don. This is Rich. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great.
Yeah, I enjoyed listening to your opening there. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on here with the economy, and I think it's like you say, a lot of this stuff that seems such a crisis and hit us all of a sudden from out of nowhere, one has to speculate if this isn't the same type of situation as the 911 event, which was planned for years. Are you going to share some more on that, on some of your things on the presidential candidates you're writing, the Three Stooges Go to Washington?
Oh, yes. In fact, quite unexpectedly, I found myself wading through a cesspool of the topic that I was just talking a little bit about. And I suspected that was somewhere in the works, but I never imagined it was what it was. Interestingly, if I can just add a caveat to my comments,
yeah.
I was listening to Webster Tarpley on Jeff Rentz's show this evening on another network. He's not on PBS. Jeff has had his own show for quite a number of years. And Webster was talking about this very issue, this bailout, and they're asking for $700 billion.
Right.
And many of the things he was saying are things that I've discovered. So I know that I'm right on with it, and he's brought up the issue of, the candidates basically are just pandering to the powers that be. They're controlled by these bankers. Their campaigns are financed by the bankers and the wealthy, the George Soroses out there and the Rupert Murdochs. These people are secretly giving money to these guys, and they're presenting these stances to us that, we have to fight terrorism, when in reality this is all about organized crime, pure and simple organized crime at the deepest level that you can imagine. And you yourself have experienced that, so this is no exaggeration. This goes hand in hand, both with what we're going to talk about tonight and what I've been researching and what I'm even hearing other historians. Tarpley's an author and a historian too, and he tends to look at the political aspects of these things, and I kind of get into the nitty-gritty of the little details. So when we connect the dots between all that information, you have a pretty clear picture of who's behind it, what they're doing, and how long they've been doing it, and how much money they've made. I've been saying, in closing my comments, for the past 6 months, I've been saying that it's anywhere between $1.5 quadrillion to $2 quadrillion that has been stolen. And he came out with that same figure this evening. I was kind of surprised. I wonder if he's been listening to Evident Footprints or those are actual facts that he's heard. But
well, if you're seeking the truth, everybody seeking the truth is going to find themselves on the same plane and discovering the same lie, which a lot of the people involved in all the shenanigans is using to hide their real identity. And that's kind of interesting that you're delving into these identities and finding out that so much of this is a lie. It's fascinating when I read these Three Stooges Go to Washington investigations, and it's spooky, scary, I guess is the word I should use, and you find out, gee, what's really happening out there.
Does it have a ring of truth to you?
Well, as far as the what I find out, like what you said, is that when you're coming in from a different angle, and you start to realize, well, wait a minute, this is actually kind of seems to be actually coming from this direction rather than this direction. This faking right, going left type of stuff is constantly being a classic MO, I guess. I'm not as much of an investigator, and so you're way out there ahead of me on those things. I can only present my own story as far as what I find is a bunch of lies, etc. And I guess we'll get a chance to talk about that if we as we go through this. I think that as you mentioned this, you know, all this just quadrillions and quadrillions of debt and things like that, it reminds me of the example that I used in my addiction model about, well, how does actually somebody find peace, or how do you address reality versus expectations, which is essentially the challenge for all of us. And in a way to address our addictions, as you mentioned, I'm the author of The Scientific Model of Addiction. It's in the $5.2 billion OxyContin suit. And that's kind of the story that got me involved in the current event. Do you remember, Don, when I, in the model of addiction, I share the story of the princess which kissed the frog? Do you remember that?
Yes.
And the rest of the story, which is so important that people forget to tell and to understand, that after everybody was celebrating, and of course there's money for everybody and everybody's going to be rich and everybody's going to live forever, the prince looks at the princess and says, but why would a princess kiss a frog? And of course, the whole party just goes silent. You could cut the air with a knife. And the princess turns beak red, and she puts her chin down on her chest, and she looks up at him with her lips trembling and says, because I too was once a frog. And the moral of the story being that we're all actually frogs. We're spending enormous amounts of money in debt, and we're going into debt for the generations of our great-grandchildren, trying to pretend as though we're all princes and princesses. And this is really the addiction itself that gets us into trouble. And we've become addicted to this concept that we have to be better than everybody. I think, what is it, the Prairie Home Companion fellow that says all of the children are above average? Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what is that? I forgot what that fellow's name is. He's on the Saturday evening PBS on the Prairie Home Companion. He says all of the children are above average. Well, something which we have a trouble facing in our life is that, gee, it's okay to be the frog. And there's intrinsic value and worth in the frog. The concept is not so much to dwell on the idea that we're all frogs as much as the idea that, you know, we have intrinsic value and worth without all feeling as though we have to be richer and more powerful than everybody else. Because this is essentially the predicating force that goes behind all this debt, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and then there's so much focus on the physical as well. Everything that we're bombarded with in terms of advertising and image, this thing about how you look and how others look, and we should strive to look like others. That's all the illusion, and that in and of itself becomes an addiction, I think.
It's a quest for control. I think the best thing for me to do is back up and let me give a little bit of my bio to the people that are listening for the first time, and then and kind of plug into where we're at currently. I call from Tennessee tonight. My business was all in Virginia. I manage the emergency department of a hospital. And had an industrial medicine program and established a preferred provider association back in the 90s. And we were able to turn a bankrupt hospital into the most profitable hospital in the state of Virginia, top 100 in the nation.
I misspoke. I apologize for that.
Yeah, that's okay. I just wanted to clear certain things. I was able to... anyway,
okay, now I just lost your voice.
I was going to use possibly some footnotes there to go over, and I'm not certain what happened.
Okay.
I was on another radio program, and all the telephones went down during the broadcast, so let me continue. In the in 96, I retired out of the from emergency emergency medicine specialty, went into primary care, supporting emergency medicine and family practice, and I was confronted with chronic pain management, which was a big part of primary care medicine. I mean, most family physicians and internal medicine physicians do a lot of chronic pain management, whether or not they specialize in it. And I was challenged with the idea that I really didn't know how to do chronic patient care, chronic pain management, because I had been doing emergency medicine. We just didn't have to do that. So I talked to a lot of my friends that were in primary care, and I discovered that they really hadn't established any protocols for themselves either. I got interested in, I eventually established the pain management protocols for the state of Virginia. That was an interesting experience in itself. That actually came through an investigation, which turned out to be a false report by somebody. The investigator, Jennifer Baker, of the Virginia Board of Medicine, had followed up the investigator report, and she later described the fact that it was against somebody else, but she decided to go ahead and pursue mine. When she investigated my book, she stated that the board wanted to investigate me because I was doing a pain management center, and they didn't have any protocols. And she reviewed my protocols. She stated that they were excellent. And what was even more important is that I followed the protocols. She brought them back to Richmond, Virginia, and they adopted them in Bonn. I eventually established the pain management protocol, or assisted with the pain management protocols for Purdue Pharma, is the company that manufactured OxyContin. I became a speaker for Purdue Pharma and lectured to pain management physicians in what they call the Partners Against Pain. I found out after the fact that I was a target in three different grand juries by a Medicare fraud agent who wanted to take me down, or take me off the streets, as they stated. I'd been targeted, as all pain management physicians had been targeted, by the Justice Department. I later found out that they were doing that because OxyContin is a favorite drug on the street of the Drug Task Force for raising money, similar to cocaine. And as people know now, interdiction doesn't just mean setting up buying scams in order to entrap potential dealers. They sell contraband on the streets and supposedly to entrap drug dealers. And then the next question, which people forget to ask or avoid asking, I guess is really the proper way of stating it, is what do they do with all that money? You know?
Well, I have a question, if I can ask you, Rich.
Yeah, go ahead.
And this is for the listening audience. Okay, you're describing a situation where this is a prescription drug, but they are selling it on the streets. Who is they? Who is behind this, ultimately?
Well, directly, you know, it's some person that got in trouble with the law, and then they're used by the Drug Task Force Agency, which is involved in the war on drugs. I call it the war with drugs.
So this is the DEA you're saying then?
Well, specifically speaking,
or CIA, FBI.
all of the above, all of the alphabet soup stuff. Specifically with the OxyContin matter, it's Clinton and probably most likely Joe Biden was involved with.
Vice presidential candidate Joe Biden.
Correct. When, okay. You recall when Clinton got in trouble back in the 90s, he sent the vice presidential candidate Al Gore to speak to Hasidic Jews of Chabad. That's the connection between basically Israel and the Goya, the non-Gentiles, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly thereafterwards, all those troubles kind of melted away, and everybody was happy. Everybody sang Kumbaya, and things moved on. Well, it's also interesting to note that the manufacturing plant of Israel, the manufacturing plant of OxyContin was moved from the United States to Israel. I learned more and more specifically of actually what happens is that the Mossad brings it now to the United States. It's transferred to basically in the east, eastern half of the United States anyway, through the Dixie Mafia. It's sent out to the different distributorships around the country. And the money from this eventually finds its way back into primarily politicians' campaign chests. I'm sure there's, you know, it's at the discretion of large U.S. attorneys in different districts of the country.
It's funny you should mention Bill Clinton and Al Gore, two known practicing Satanists. So I would presume that they wouldn't put it in the hands of anyone but other practicing Satanists.
Yeah, so. It seems as though when Jesus gave when Jesus was tempted by Lucifer on the mountain, and Lucifer told him that he give him all the kingdoms of the world if he would only bow and worship to him. Someone told me one time that, you know, was that a real temptation or not? Was that true or not? And I said, well, I assume the basic story is true at least. And he says, well, then that means that Lucifer controls all the kingdoms of the world, doesn't it? And it made me pause for a minute and think, well, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but maybe there's a point to ponder there.
Well, Satan would have promised Al Gore the internet, which he invented, right? and then I guess he gave him global warming too. What's next? The pits of hell, right?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but you.
The only place to go. It'd just go down from there.
Right. I hadn't thought of it that way. Some of this stuff, well, let me continue real briefly with
sure.
the background. We'll get into some of this stuff. In 1998, the hospital that I had my business associations with, as I stated, I had the contract to staff and manage the emergency room in the 90s. And then in 96, I started an outpatient medical center in Scott County, Virginia. All this is happening around Southwest Virginia. That's pretty much all my professional career. And the hospital I worked with had some problems financially because of changes in the healthcare reimbursement in 97. And they went into a big cash flow crisis because the reimbursement changed, and a lot of the clinics that the hospital owned weren't doing as well. And because the community was pretty much, it was a small, old coal mining county, and so the small rural hospital was the primary employer. When it started having trouble, the whole community started having trouble. And it turned out that they did a big investigation because the hospital started that was going to close its doors. A lot of people were upset. I mean, they were personally affected by this. People were literally going bankrupt. Yeah, they had a federal investigation. During that investigation, they found out one of the local judges was involved in embezzling from the hospital of 300% medical equipment leases. Well, judges don't go down in Southwest Virginia for their crimes, so they had to find somebody else to do his time for him. And it turns out that they decided me because, guess what? I was the target of three federal grand juries, and they couldn't get me off the streets as they wanted to. And so I was the perfect guy. So they made the judge's co-defendant my co-defendant. And then I eventually got a tape recording of my co-defendant admitting what happened. He explained that his daughter's boyfriend was involved in the sheriff's OxyContin ring. Imagine that. And they set him up to get, at that time they were getting OxyContin in Mexico. This is before the deal went through and OxyContin was made in Israel. They sent him down to Mexico and got 1,300 OxyContin. Arrested him on the way back. And then they had, because he was driving my co-defendant's car, they said they were going to set him up in conspiracy, etc. Well, I got that tape recording of that confession after the trial, and I found some documents which showed that the prosecutor knew that the federal judge was involved in the cover-up through his partner, and he had withheld those documents from me. I was warned that if I didn't lie down, I was going to spend the rest of my life in prison, right before I went to prison. I didn't lie down. After that, they tried to kill me. When they couldn't kill me, they ended up killing that boyfriend of the administrator's daughter. That was one of the lies which Senator Specter confronted Attorney General Gonzalez with when he said, we've got dead bodies here. He wasn't talking about overdoses. He was talking about the whole OxyContin fiasco in this particular case. You can look up John Brownlee Testifies, and you can kind of get more of the story.
So this young man was murdered while he was in jail, is what you're saying.
Yes, in jail, yeah. And so I didn't lie down. I go to prison, and as I stated, I had a confession of the judge's co-defendant, who was my co-defendant, explaining why he said it was a kickback. And it turns out, unfortunately, as I stated, the federal judge, Jones, who was involved in the my criminal trial, the hospital trial, also is involved in the $634.5 million OxyContin resolution and also involved in the $5.2 billion OxyContin case against me. He was up to his eyeballs in the hospital case, used faulty jury instructions, and then illegally altered the jury instructions during my trial or right up after my trial when the community found out what was going on. While I'm in prison, they took the judge who was involved in stealing from the hospital. He dropped indictments against my former patients in return for rigiding the $5.2 billion case. Remember this name, Emmett Urey, E-M-M-I-T-T, Urey, Y-E-A-R-Y. He's the money man in Southwest Virginia. He's the guy that Boucher and Biden and Obama and Warner and all these guys go to visit. It's interesting that Obama and Warner are going to Southwest Virginia a lot lately. You notice that?
Yes. Now, what is Emmett Urey's calling?
Pardon all this?
Yes.
Emmett Urey is the attorney who filed the $5.2 billion OxyContin suit in June 15, 2001. When I didn't lie down, and they told me I was going to spend the rest of my life in prison. I didn't lie down. So a suit was filed by Emmett Urey in Lee County, Virginia, naming me as a co-defendant involving Charles Ewing. Charles Ewing just happened to, remember this name, Charles Ewing just happened to be a patient of mine who went to court to get a copy of the faulty jury instructions which Judge Jones wrote that put me in prison and then illegally altered. when this was discovered, he was handing these jury instructions out at the corners of Morgan Street, that's Main Street, I guess you'd say, in Lee County, Virginia, and showing everybody what happened as I was being used as a scapegoat. This is interesting that Emmett Urey, the money man in Southwest Virginia that controls the money of what used to be cocaine money and now is OxyContin money in Southwest Virginia and feeds it off to all the politicians, he was the one that filed this $5.2 billion OxyContin suit. Charles Ewing had gotten in some trouble, the story goes, and he had indictments dropped in return for filing the $5.2 billion suit. Now, I want to share with the listeners that despite this, Charles Ewing nor any other patient ever claimed that I had misused my privileges. Of the $5.2 billion bounty on my head, not one patient ever claimed that I had misused my privileges. And that was, I guess, part of the reason why they let me out of prison. I like to joke with people that I'm the most blessed man in the world. Saddam Hussein only had $25 million on his head. I had $5.2 billion on my head, and I'm still talking to you. So are we starting to connect a few of the dots as to what's going on here now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty clear. Now, could we go into a little bit of detail as to the roles that these politicians played, if you want to, I'm particularly interested in Biden and Obama for obvious reasons, but are there any Republicans? Is this a Democrat thing going on here? Were they using this to finance campaigns? Or is this turned into lobbying money? Is it just part of the general corruption that we're seeing?
The go-by with drug money really started unofficially, I guess, more in the 70s, more officially in the 80s. You have to remember that in 1980s, it's come out on the History Channel now that George Bush Sr. went and visited Pablo Escobar. Probably a lot of listeners have seen the History Channel's investigation of this, and they tell the story of it. Of course, they leave out a lot of important facts. And then shortly after George Bush went and set up the deal with Pablo Escobar, they eliminate Pablo Escobar. Many of the listeners may have seen the movie Clear and Present Danger.
Yes.
Basically, it's based on a true story where the United States government essentially just threw in the towel and said, we're not going to fight this anymore. We're just going to control it. If that's nice, we'll assume that's their motive. But, so when they go into controlling it, they're making hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars. And, you know, pretty soon you got hundreds of billions of dollars a year you're making off this. And, they begin to realize that, how can we share this with anybody as noble as us? And then pretty soon, it's like everybody else, you get used to that money, you start making budgets, and pretty soon, like everybody else, you start spending more than you're making. So you got to make more. Now, the terrible tragedy behind the OxyContin cartel is that, if you recall, in the late 90s and early 2000s, in order to raise more money because of all the hot and heavy political campaigns that have been going on. Well, gee, how much more money could you make with OxyContin if you just got rid of the pain management doctors? Do you remember that the pain management, all pain management physicians have been targeted by Attorney Generals Reno, Ashcroft, and Gonzalez? I do not know that if Mukasey has continued to follow suit with this, if his directive is all follow target pain management doctors, but I certainly know that he was put in by Schumer to hide and cover up the OxyContin fiasco, which is what caused Gonzalez to resign. You remember that when Senator Specter confronted Gonzalez on his U.S. attorney firings, he was very flippant. He was very cool. He didn't care. And Senator Spector confronted him on July 24, 2007, right after the OxyContin deal went down in Judge Jones's court on the 20th of July, 2007. Senator Spector said, "What about this OxyContin matter?" And all of a sudden, it just took everybody by surprise, and Gonzalez bristled and looked questioning at first, then angry at first, then red. And if you remember, Spector looked over at Leahy, and Leahy looked over at Spector like, "Yep, we got him. There's dead bodies here, and we're going to investigate that, too." And that was the end of Attorney General Gonzalez. And the interesting thing is that was a big coup. The Democrats had regained control through that particular confrontation. The Democrats regained control of the OxyContin cartel and all the money involved. I continue to digress, but the point I was going to state is that the pain management physicians were targeted, taken out of the offices, made to look like they were all a bunch of pill doctors, Dr. Feelgoods, and things like that. And I'm not going to say that there couldn't have been some bad apples out there. But the real intent behind that was the fact that, the U.S. government / drug task force had gotten involved in the pain management market, and they were getting $40 a pill on the street. And could you imagine if patients actually just went to the physician and got these for $40 a bottle instead of $40 a pill, what that would do to the lifeline of this bureaucracy?
Yeah.
These things start to make sense, don't they?
Yeah. Well, there's this ruse that there's a war on drugs. I think that when they started printing that mantra on bumper stickers and posters and signs and cards and buttons, what they should have done is put the word "on drugs" in parentheses.
With drugs, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Or with drugs.
Right now we have a war and they're on drugs.
Yeah,
it's,
right. I understand your also, right?
Put it in the parentheses. It's you're drawing attention to the fact that they're on drugs. That's just a creative license, literary license.
Go ahead.
You know, the thing that is really appalling to me, and it's, you know, you pointed out that we didn't have an addiction model, but this was going on. I mean, you were framed. OxyContin was being sold, and in a moment I'd like you to comment on how long this has been going on as far as the drug and what the components, the addictive components are in the drug. But the fact that without an addiction model, they're selling this highly addictive drug through doctors and on the street for Lord knows a thousand times what it would cost, or if not more. There's a lot to that. There's a lot of culpability and a lot of liability, it seems.
Yeah, let me answer your question. That one of the things I like to clarify is they call it prescription drug fraud. And I get very frustrated and I say, this is not politically correct. You know, everybody wants to be politically correct. This is pharmaceutical drug fraud. There were no prescriptions written by physicians probably for 95% of or more, a higher percentage of all the OxyContin on the street. This comes directly from the factory in Israel. Here's a perfect case, Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh, you know, when they started investigating, they found out that he wasn't getting it from 90% of it wasn't coming from physicians. It was coming off the street. You know, you have a higher and higher percentage of overdoses of OxyContin and supposed crime related with OxyContin. They always like to say prescription drug fraud, and they, you know, make the pain management doctors feel bad and drive pain management physicians out of the clinics because they're a bunch of no good people. Well, that just feeds into the perfect business model that they're running, where they can keep the price at $40 a pill and run their campaign war chest up to the, you know, to keep the budget up, because that's really what it's all about now. If you're going to be a good politician, and you're good because the media say you're good, and they say you're good in the article because you're buying ad time from them. Anybody knows advertising, it's not the ad that does your advertising, it's the article. The ad just talks about your name. Well, you got to buy the ad in order to get the article. And so if you got the money, you get the good article. If you don't have the money, you don't get the good article. And as we were just talking about Joe Biden, he's on the Senate Judiciary Committee. If you remember, he's the one that helped create the drug czar. Remember that term, the drug czar? Not the director, not the DEA director, the czar. He's the one, he's literally the czar.
Well, yeah, and the czars are known prior to that as the dictators of Russia and the Soviet Union. You know, I mean, when you hear the word czar, you're thinking of this political figure that's a monster, basically. So
exactly. Isn't it interesting that at the Democratic campaign, Clinton says, "I love Joe Biden." He didn't say, "I love Obama." If you knew the history, that there's kind of that saying, "Let those with ears listen." Between these type of statements, there's a lot of hidden meaning between those statements. I love Joe Biden. Joe Biden's on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's involved with the war with drugs policy. He was involved in the invention of the drug czar. He was involved during a lot of the design of the whole reconstruction of the Justice Department to help to basically money launder all the forfeitures involved in you know, this started out with the war with drugs, that they could take the assets of those people involved in selling drugs. And they still do that, of course. But now they have such a big pipeline connection in Spokane. It goes right to Colombia. If anybody wonders why the big interest in Venezuela versus Colombia and all the Russian flotilla going down there, they're getting ready to stop that pipeline, George Bush pipeline from Colombia called cocaine. You know, that's one of the major commodities in the Western Hemisphere, runs our system. And if you want to go right for George Bush's jugular, boy, Russia's getting ready to do it. You think these are coincidences? They're not.
So in the hearings then, with these Senate hearings, where they're nailing Gonzalez to the wall, basically, it gives the illusion, if you're watching the hearing, that they've entrapped Gonzalez to the point where basically all it really represents is it shifts the power or the control of the OxyContin cartel, shifts from the Republicans to the Democrats.
Exactly. That was a major political coup. You know, we don't have militiamen chasing congressmen out of the Capitol building. We get control of the Justice Department because these are the guys where all the money's going through, the war with drugs. And they, if you remember, Senator Schumer put in Attorney General Mukasey. Well, gee, it was the very issue which predicated Gonzalez's resignation, the OxyContin issue, which Senator Spector promised to follow up on. Have you heard anything more about it?
No, that was it, yeah.
In fact, they did, in fact, have one small little interview with a guy named U.S. Attorney Brownlee. Now, I didn't even know that this had happened until just, I guess it's been a couple months ago. Interestingly enough, C-SPAN didn't cover that particular matter. They did have one more to connect the dots between U.S. Attorney Brownlee and Gonzalez and myself. U.S. Attorney Brownlee was the one that got the $634.5 million. This was supposed to feed a $500 million foundation for pain management and addiction prevention based on my new model. This was Congress and eventually joined in. President Bush eventually joined in support. You'll review the 2007 State of the Union Address. He requested $600 million. Congress had actually said $500 million. To have a pain management addiction prevention foundation, because we really can prevent and treat addiction now. Physicians really can do pain management much better than we really can prevent a lot of crime and suffering and unhappiness. And have you seen that yet? I haven't.
Well, you know, what comes to mind too, Richard, is that in, I'm trying to think of the year. It seems like it was the late 90s, maybe 97, 98. There were all these multi-billion dollar settlements. Now, whether this actually occurred or not is one thing, but I think it was just a means through funneling money, probably for political purposes, to the state attorneys general. And there were a number of states that filed suit against the tobacco companies. And I can recall such and such a state gets $5 billion. I can tell you Ohio got something like $5 billion. And that money was to be spent on treating the addictions. In that case, it was smoking, whether it was cigarettes or pipe tobacco or chewing tobacco or snuff, whatever addictions are related to tobacco. That money disappeared. That money, there are no programs. In fact, after they got that money and they blew the money, they started passing laws against smoking in public places. So it wasn't like they had to fight that, and they certainly didn't use that money to fight that problem.
You remember the FISA? Remember the FISA legislation, which Obama was supposedly going to filibuster to his last breath if they ever try to bring it to the floor, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
That was a classic case where the guys from, EFF Electronic Foundation, had basically won the case against ATT for the wire dropping, eavesdropping.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a classic case where essentially the plaintiffs won and the Justice Department had a bunch of money transferred to Congress, and then Congress just passes a law and basically avoids the whole thing. The whole system is just... The Justice Department system is gone.
It's like they set up that litigation just for the purpose of producing the money so that they can get it into their hands. It's not about handling a problem or solving some injustice. It's just it's a cash cow. They just create a scenario to have this money be on the table.
And
the dumbed down public just lets it happen. No one is accountable for any of it either.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking about when you were raising the point about the $700 billion bailout. I wonder if $700 will bail anybody out. I wonder if this will just be a transfer of money into some rotten politicians' pockets and everything will just go its way into bankruptcy anyway. When I hear reports, I forgot the new Japanese prime minister, he used to be the finance prime minister. He's threatening to not even go through with the deal. This is what most people may not be aware of, is that while the taxpayers are ultimately responsible, the money's not coming from the taxpayers right now. The money's coming from banks in Japan, Korea, and China. Benjamin Fulford talked about this for the last year. He had an interview with David Rockefeller about it.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, they were threatening to basically allow the United States to be bankrupt. His last interview in September with the Project Camelot people, Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy, say that, yeah, they pretty much had struck a deal, but they're not 100% certain it's going to happen. You read in the news, that's exactly what's happening now, that the Prime Minister, or I can't say his name, his Japanese name, the new Prime Minister says, you know, we're not certain that we're even going to do this because the whole purpose of this is to keep interest rates low. And the fact of the matter is the American people there don't care what the interest rates are. They're not going to buy anything. That's just where the economy is right now. And
well, you know, this whole scenario, whether we're talking about drugs or we're talking about real estate or we're talking about money that's allocated for health purposes, you know, for clinical help or foundational studies on tackling these issues, it's all organized crime is all it is. There's nothing about this that's legitimate. Let's use the real estate just briefly as an example. That's like us going to jail because someone committed a murder. The whole country has to go to jail to serve this guy's conviction. And
well, it's all just a big facade. This is a perfect case in point where this was $500 million of health care money. And guess what they did? They stole it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, whether you think that socialized medicine is a good idea or a bad idea, I know that the big American companies like Ford and GM would love it because they can't handle the cost of health care in their business product cycle. And so some people say we ought to go to socialized medicine. And the reason not to go to socialized medicine? Because they steal it.
Yeah.
It's a classic example. They stole it.
But they're stealing it from these holding companies, too. This is the other issue. And this is one way that they launder the money. They put the money into a holding company, all right? Now, a holding company can be an insurance company. It can be a real estate.
AIG. Yeah, yeah. You're right.
Yeah, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And so they have ways of sheltering the money in accounts. And their favorite is to put it in hedge funds and derivatives because they can gamble with it. They can play with it, and it's dependent upon things that are happening in the market. So if they want to make the value of their stock go up, you know, in these derivatives and hedge funds, they're highly speculative, and they're secret. The Security Exchange Commission knows about this. The drug companies are involved in this, the oil companies are involved, and the banks. They're all in it together, and they're padding the pockets of the politicians. And here I am using alliteration, not intentionally.
Yeah. Well,
they're padding the pockets of the politicians. And then they're creating these laws, and then they say, well, we have to, in order to save the economy, or in order to stop crime, or in order to stop drugs from coming into the country, or to stop terrorism, we have to raise this money. And so the people have to do it. They create a war, we pay for it. They murder our citizens, we pay for it. They cause the illnesses, we pay for it. They steal money from the banks. We pay for it. They steal money from the insurance companies. We pay for it. It's nonstop crime. That's all it is. That's all it is.
It's a license to steal. Politics has become a license to steal. Yeah. They steal. And what's even more unfortunate, I felt the pain, not just financially. They stole my honor. They stole my life. They stole my family. You know, they stole my business. If they had just taken my money, I'd been happy. But when they take your honor and they take your life in place of their own, you start to, as Clinton would say, feel the pain, you know.
Yes.
Yeah,
now, what is your opinion on what this is doing to America? What is it doing to the American citizens that are hooked on these drugs, that are addicted to these drugs? And let's talk about that, and let's get the listening audience involved in if possible, in doing something.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because as most people know, the person that's actually been doing the reporting on the OxyContin matter and the addiction matter is a fellow named Brian Ross. Brian Ross is the lead investigating agent of ABC News. And Brian knows the whole story, and I'm disappointed that Brian hasn't followed up on this, because what you said is exactly what most people think. What is going on with it when they're addicted to OxyContin? And Don, you've taken the time to read the article, and you understand that the whole issue is the misunderstanding of addiction. Nobody is addicted to OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
What they are dependent on OxyContin. They have withdrawal symptoms when they try to get off OxyContin. And so people think that, you know, that I have an addiction, and that is true.
But it's through the OCD, as you described it.
Exactly, exactly. People get addicted, and this is what won the case and threw out all the cases and saved Purdue Pharma billions and gave us hope to do better, and which originated a $634 million resolution. People get addicted to washing their hands, to control over people, to money, to work, to sex, to cleaning. And where's the stimulus there? There isn't any. Conversely, there's... Go ahead.
I was going to add one thing, but I didn't mean to interrupt. The one thing is denial.
Exactly.
I think that's our biggest addiction about everything, is denial.
Well, has to do with addiction to control. When people deny the fact that they're frogs, that they make mistakes, that they have failures, then what I think that actually leads to is an addiction to control, and a failure to recognize that, you know what, I have value when I'm not in control, and you have value, and things like that. And we can go through the model. Let me proceed a little bit here with what I was thinking about. The tragedy of the failure to establish the foundation, not just the financial tragedy or the expenditures, I should say, because of so much money being wasted on redundant exams and tests and Social Security disability by people that are just trying to justify their opiate dependence. The tragedy, the biggest tragedy I was sharing with a friend, and actually he's a very smart fellow, and he picked it up really quick. He said, you know, Doc, when people understand addiction, they understand their will, they understand their compulsions, and they understand, and they have energy. I said, yeah, think how much energy people would have to do good things if they weren't trying to fight their dysphoria and their unhappiness associated with their lack of understanding their will and their energy to direct their resources into positive things. When the government keeps us confused about addiction because they think, oh, you're on this high-powered cocaine or OxyContin or alcohol and you have no hope, and unfortunately the 12-step program has some major flaws in it, which actually cause more addiction problems than it solves, as we know. You wreck families. People think they have bad protoplasm. They think they're just born to be an addict. You've heard it's a disease. It's only a disease in that it's related to obsessive-compulsive disorder, and that happens to be associated with affective disorders like depression and anxiety, etc. And I almost have to go through the addiction model. I hope that you get a chance. Perhaps you'll post it on one of your websites so people can read it, because it really does require a little bit of an outline. It requires about 20 to 30 minutes of people's time to walk through it to understand it. But when people understand that the variable between a person's dependence and addiction is obsessive-compulsive disorder, then they can start to say, wait a minute, I can actually address this. I don't know if do you drink coffee in the morning, and do you know people that drink coffee in the morning, Don?
If I'm awake in the morning, I drink it.
Yeah, right.
I may drink it at various times in the day or night. It depends, but...
Well, that's right. Your schedule's different.
Yeah.
But most people will... A lot of people get up and they drink coffee in the morning, and they say, well, if I don't have my coffee, I don't feel good. In fact, if I go a day or two without coffee, I might even get headaches and grouchiness and stuff. Well, that's a classic dependence withdrawal phenomenon. Most people would believe, though, that if they were out somewhere up in the mountains and they didn't have coffee, they'd make it through a couple of days of withdrawal. And they wouldn't say this is an addiction. Now, some people would actually say, no, I've got an addiction. It may be true because they have an obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But if we understand that addiction is a manifestation of an obsessive compulsive disorder combined with a dependence withdrawal phenomenon, then they can say, well, wait a minute. You know, that's true. In fact, I have some of these obsessive compulsive traits. And I know that addict. He is an obsessive compulsive person. Isn't this interesting? That's exactly how I discovered the formula. Let's go back just a little bit. I'm in prison doing the judge's time. They file this $5.2 billion suit. I see attorneys doing the same things which they had, that I saw the hospital attorneys doing. And I said, forget it. They're going to make good on their threat to put me in prison for the rest of my life. I'm not going to pay somebody else to do it. I fired the attorneys and I fought the $5.2 billion suit with a 39-cent pen from prison. And I'm literally answering the plaintiff's questions with this pen, and there's 100-and-something questions. And I'm getting bored and frustrated going through this, and I thought, what is the issue here? And then it scared me to death, because as a lecturer for pain management physicians, I realized we did not have a scientific definition of addiction. I literally dropped the pen out of my hand and probably turned white if anybody looked at me. I said, they're going to make good on their promise. They're going to put me in prison for the rest of my life. I know what they can do with black and white. Can you imagine what they can do with gray? We do not have a scientific definition.
Well, even, you know, even with that, I think of the danger of drugs, and I don't mean to take us off on a tangent. I saw something last night for a new drug, and I can't remember if it was for the heart or circulation or whatever it was. I don't remember the name or anything, but what stuck out most is that three times the commercial was more about side effects than it was about the drug. And they made this comment twice in recapping the side effects. They said, in some patients, this medicine, and they called it medicine, that's what was interesting. This medicine causes blindness, deafness, and they went on with, heart problems, heart palpitation, loss of blood pressure. And they said, if you suffer from blindness or deafness, call your doctor right away. Now, what my mind thinks of, because I listen carefully to every word, my mind thinks of, if you're suffering from blindness and deafness, first of all, you've got to find the phone. Okay. Now, who are you going to talk to?
Deafness.
Once you find the phone, you know. I mean, this is the logic that they use. They put this crap out there, and people just eat it up.
That's funny. That one went above me, I guess.
and I'm going to have to educate myself as to what the name of it is, but it really doesn't matter because they have the same side effects for the penile growth pill Viagra, Cialis, Enzyte, it doesn't matter. You know, they all have these side effects. I mean, if it's causing your body to grow in one area, think of what it's doing in other parts of your body.
Wasn't that the threat anyway? You'll go blind and deaf?
Yeah. And then they follow it up with a hand cream commercial. Well, yeah, this is a G show, so we don't want to go too far off and have to change the rating. But It just never ceases to amaze me that in light of what you're talking, and I'm not seeing any addiction model talked about here. You know, they're not talking about if you take this for a certain period of time, you're going to be addicted. It's that they want the addiction. They're encouraging and promoting the addiction, which is the very essence of the commercial.
Right.
You know, despite the fact that you have created this addiction model, they're not enforcing it. It's obvious.
Well, there's a lot of misperception out there. Let me ask you a question. You probably know the answer, and you can either answer the right answer or you can play along. This is in my addiction model article. Don, how many paths do you have?
How many what?
Paths. How many paths? Like, you got a past and a present. How many paths do you have?
Well, I look at it as an eternal now. There was a time when I used to look at it as a past, and it would just be one.
Right.
Back then. But now I see everything as an eternal now, so...
For those of us that aren't on the same spiritual plane as Don, who live in time and space and we move through things in a linear fashion, the old, you know, lower group of us that haven't ascended, and I'm tongue in cheek, but I do understand what you're saying,
and I'm not being a smart aleck by answering that way. So
no, and that just gives us something else to talk about, because you are true in that sense. But for the simple concrete people like me and most of the audience out there, we have a past and a present and a future. And most people would say, well, you got one past. But the reality is we actually have essentially two or more pasts. We have the real past and we have the expected past or the ideal past, what we wanted to have happened past. And if you look at people that are troubled, if you look at people that are not energetic, that are depressed and anxious and have a lot of affective disorders, as a physician who saw patients frequently, I could tell you they were spending enormous amounts of time in this little recess in their mind where they massage some life-changing event or frustrating issue as if they could change it. Have you ever seen people like that, Don?
Oh yeah, it's the old axiom of repeating the same mistake but expecting a different outcome every time.
Yeah, Freud calls it fixation. And mm-hmm. when certain of those things happen at certain critical times of your life, a certain challenge that they didn't get through or whatever, he calls it being fixated at that specific stage in development of their life. And what I like to kind of share with people is that, you know, you've got two pasts, don't you? And they'll say, what do you mean? I say, well, you're spending a lot of time, I'll be talking to a patient, I'll say, you're spending a lot of time on this one particular past event as if you could change it. Do you perceive that you could have changed this? And they'll say, no. And I'll say, well, it's interesting because I remember asking you about this before, and you actually described it as different, as if it was actually a different way that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see people doing frequently, and they spend enormous amount of money doing this, and they spend enormous amount of time, again, trying to be the prince, wanting to be the prince in their mind. And everybody wants to be the prince, or everybody wants to be the princess. They spend enormous amounts of energy and money and time set pretending as though we're somebody other than who we are. Now, I don't mean to discourage people from improving things. They can. But the question is, I'm trying to get at is, when you look at how much unhappiness people have by trying to change the past, trying to change the present, trying to lie about the present as to who we are or what we're doing or what our capacities are.
Okay, I lost Richard's audio there. I'm not hearing him. Seth, if you're listening, can you make sure we still have Dr. Norton with us? I don't know if I've lost everybody or Seth, if you're there, if you can double check on Dr. Norton's connection for us.
Can you hear me now, Don?
Oh, yes, I can.
Good. I'm sorry.
Did you go into the past there or the future? And was it the real one or the false one?
I'm just rambling on here at 2:30 in the morning Eastern Standard Time. I'm sorry I lost you. I don't know what happened. I could hear you. You just couldn't hear me.
Yeah, I couldn't hear
you. Maybe there was an intention for that. I apologize.
That's okay.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is that when people have a hard time comparing or addressing reality with their expectations, what they're saying is that I'm unhappy. And I think that it's important for people to understand addiction. They really have to understand maybe it was my voice the whole time was bad. Maybe that's what you're doing.
Oh, you went dumb on us.
You're taking that stuff, maybe, huh? You're coming out of the closet finally, Don. You too, we can unveil.
I was just making light of the fact that I covered blindness and deafness. The only thing left was the dumbing down part, so it just...
We'll get you there. Talk to me long enough. We'll get you there. You've got to ask yourself, when a person misuses some kind of stimulus, whether it's cocaine or heroin or whatever it is, work, sex, control, cleaning, our politicians are addicted to control. And what you're talking about now, where they're literally devising schemes to steal more and more and more, well, an addiction to control, and they're out of control. They need to go into rehab. One of the things which people have a hard time understanding is, why are they doing it? Well, they're unhappy. Life is pretty simple when you really get down to the basic things. We seek to be happy. We seek to avoid unhappiness. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, in the case of politicians, it's a path they follow because they have been compromised in some manner, and it's
exactly.
It entails blackmail and extortion and Lord knows what else. Just public humiliation is enough, I think.
It becomes a whole game. There's a whole industry on different facets of the game and the addictions to the game and the addictions to the addictions and everything. It's become crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things I realized I had to do when I would be in prison and I would have an addict that would come to me and say, Doc, I've been through 500 hours of just say no, and I'm going to say yeah. I don't think I'll make it on the street. I had to start setting up some type of outline to explain the whole model of addiction to people. And one of the things I had to help them understand is that, you know what, you're unhappy, aren't you? And they'd say, yeah, that's really ultimately the problem. And I'd say, well, if we're going to find out what happiness is, think about it, define it. I said, well, how do you define happiness? You know, I said, well, think about this. Happiness is the difference, is the difference between reality and expectations. More specifically, it's kind of an equation. It's reality over expectation. And to make an example of that, you ask yourself, if I thought I was going to make $100,000 next year and I ended up making 95 or 90, would I be happy? Probably not. Not if somebody told me I made $100,000 and I even worked a little extra. Conversely, if somebody said that I was going to make $50,000 and I took the job and I ended up making 95, I'd be very happy. It's the same amount of money, but it's my perspective. I expected $100,000, and the reality was I only made $95,000. Conversely, mm-hmm. I expected $50,000, but hey, you know what? I made $95,000. Wow, same number. But It's the difference in our perspective as to what we wanted versus what reality, you know, dealt.
Mm-hmm.
Emotionally, it's the same thing too. If I have a relationship with somebody, and I really am not expecting much love or attention from that person, and I get a lot of love and attention from that person, I'm really happy. And conversely, if I was expecting a whole lot of love and attention, and gee, they probably gave me more love and attention than every other wife in the block, but I expected more. So emotionally, I'm unhappy. That's a real important definition for people to understand addiction, because what actually starts the misuse of the stimulus, what actually continues the misuse of the stimulus, is not the tolerance, not the withdrawal, not the dependence. It's their misunderstanding of unhappiness. And if you ask any addict, they got into the problem because they were unhappy. They continued to misuse the stimulus, being cocaine or whatever it is, drugs, alcohol, because of their inability to cope with their unhappiness. And when they understand how to address their happiness better, then they can start to say, you know what? I can address this other issue of my unhappiness without this drug. Now, I may have to go through a withdrawal period, but I can do that. I can do it with the assistance of a physician, which might help me with it with different medications, or I might say, no, I can go, I'll do it cold turkey. But I know now that I'm not a, quote, addict. I know now that my dad had this problem, my granddad had this problem, my mom had this problem, all these people had this problem, but it wasn't that they were addicts. They may have also had some obsessive compulsive problems, but they misused stimulants in order to address their obsessive compulsive problems. And when they separate those issues, they can work through them much better.
See, that's now, if you were to ask me for my definition of happiness, I would probably give it to you in three forms. And I would say, number one, on a physical level, the realization of intention, specifically my intention. On the mental or the mind level, I would say the realization of my creativity. Mm-hmm. And on the spiritual level, the realization of truth.
What you're saying is that your intention is your expectation. When you realize it, when reality becomes equal with your expectations, you're happy. I would prefer to call that content. That's a 1-over-1 model. And I perceive that when reality exceeds your intentions and exceeds your expectations, then we're happy. But you're right. You've come to the same, intuitively, you've come to the same equation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, word in French, the word happiness is content, spelled just like content. So,
okay.
I think
you're less obsessive compulsive than me. I want it to exceed. Go ahead.
I was just going to say my intention is set very high. The parameter is, you know, the bar is very high. My creativity, likewise, and of course, how much higher can you go than the truth?
Well, I understand what you're saying.
Now, that doesn't mean squat to most people, but to me it means
everything. I was just going to get into people like us, because I'm an obsessive compulsive person. Every physician out there is an obsessive compulsive person. I was a workaholic. And I definitely caused my family suffering because I expressed or I manifested my obsessive compulsive disorder through work. And one of the classic, the underlying predicating force of a obsessive compulsive person is perfectionism. That's what you started to tip your hand on, that my intentions or my expectations are very high. Well, that's right. That's classic obsessive compulsive type people. They want things, quote, perfect. And So let's plug that into the equation just a second. If happiness is reality over expectations, and expectations is a very high number, then what is the total number? If the denominator, that's the bottom number, is very high, and the numerator, regardless of what the numerator is on the top of the equation, as people know, fractions, the actual value of the fraction is lower and lower as the bottom number goes higher and higher, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
1 over 10 is a lot less than 10 over 1.
Mm-hmm.
So if my happiness equation has a very high number on the bottom, that's an expectation number. And obsessive compulsives have high expectations. They're perfectionists. You know what their happiness level is? Very low. It's very, very low. And these people are often depressed and anxious, and they're constantly frustrated. So what happens is you got a kind of a self-feeding system where obsessive compulsive people tend to find stimulus make them feel better.
I'll agree with that. If I can interject that, what you're describing to me seems an issue of the ego or the false self.
It's the frog wanting to be the prince.
Yes, exactly. And yeah. You know what? That's if you look at the frog being at the bottom of the totem pole, because I know some princes that I would not want to be. If being a prince is having the money, but being a pedophile, being a Satanist, you know, I could go into it. I think I get the point across, you know, stopping right there.
Of course. There are actually very big frogs that have fabricated a lie, and that's a classic for an addiction person. They live a lie. If you ever talk to a person who's truly addicted to any stimulus, whether it's work, whether it's drugs or anything, when you try to confront them on this, they'll deny it. They have, remember we said they have two pasts, they have two presents and two futures, and in their mind, they've literally fabricated a lie of reality in order to accommodate their addiction. They're classic. I mean, you know, I would make up stories as to why I had to work because, well, it just gave me more peace. I would have to, I had patients that had to be taken care of and nobody else could do it as good as me. And I had to make certain that we had security personally and the hospital had security and all these things. And sure, that resulted financially, but my family certainly suffered because of my own personal addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you a question. Wouldn't our ultimate obsession be our survival or our desire to survive, to go on living? Wouldn't that be the utmost?
Well, it's true. That's a good point, that part of your obsessive-compulsive stimulus, which is different than an obsessive-compulsive disorder, but part of your obsessive-compulsive stimulus is your self-survival instinct. And in that article, in the model, I give an example of the deer in the forest. And if they're going to survive, when they hear a noise, they got to look up, they got to quit eating, and they got to look up and find out if that's a threat to them. On the other hand, if they're constantly paranoid about every noise that ever comes by and never take time just to, you know, eat, they're going to starve to death, and that's a classic example of these type of people when it becomes obsessive compulsive disorder.
There are people who are spiritually bulimic too. You know, it's not just on the physical level or anorexic.
Well, go ahead and explain that to me.
Well, it's like someone who's following someone else's dictate. In other words, the belief system. See, this is the essence of what this show is about. It's the essence of my journalism. It's the essence of the truth that I'm striving to bring out through the guests that I have on the show, such as yourself. There's a false self and there's the real self, and we have been given the image of the false self, and that's the image. The frog or the prince, both, we're given both, and we're told either we're going to be a frog or we're going to be a prince. There's, you know, there's no discussion about the tadpole.
Yeah.
You know, or any stage in between. Why not be an eagle and soar? Why does it have to be a frog or a prince? We're conditioned from childhood, almost from birth, we're conditioned to accept these principles. And then what, you know, how do we deal with that later on as adults? We eat frog legs, or we act as the boiling frog, you know, the water being slowly heated so that we don't jump out of the pot as it's boiling. We always hold on to this belief about the princes and the princesses, and we worship these people senselessly. Why do we worship them?
Because we don't know what justice is. I spent some interesting time with Dr. Deagle, who I've spent some time with on this particular issue with as well. When people don't really understand what justice is, they don't have an outline of where their life is to go. And the truth of the matter is, people don't understand simple definition or laws of the universe, which your shows help to elucidate. You know, laws of love, and laws of justice and things like that. I remember asking people questions, what is justice? They'll respond with a question like, or an answer like, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I'll say, no, that's judgment. What is justice? They'll think on it for a while.
Just
I'll say,
us.
Go ahead.
Just us.
Just
that's why it is today.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And to get them to understand that, I'll say, you know, give me an example of a little injustice. Well, that's when I do something and it doesn't cause to someone too much pain. Well, okay, what's a big injustice? Well, that's when somebody does something wrong to me. You know, it's kind of like what you're saying. We define it, the intensity of the injustice, based on whether we suffer or not versus whether somebody else suffers.
Mm-hmm.
In order to understand the idea of, well, how can I be happy, you know, the frog versus princess, the anti-type, is to push the example. The truth of the matter is that there are very few frogs and very few princes in life, and we have all kinds of different stations. So the question is, well, how can I know that I'm being just in my reality, and how can I know that I'm being just in my expectations? And I thought about maybe I need to put this in there, because this was, of course, the first chapter in Plato's book, The Republic, for a reason. And Thrasymachus, in his dialogue with Socrates, responds, well, justice is whatever the ruling power wanted to be. And that's probably the case. And he argues very effectively for that. And Socrates basically responds, yes, that's probably, practically speaking, what it often degenerates to. But justice, the best term for justice is the privileges and the responsibilities thereof. If you look, I remember kind of reading about this when I studied the Torah in Stone's Hebrew version. When God created the world as a master designer, I don't want to get into evolution versus creation and time spans and all that stuff, but let's just go with the outline of God's creation as outlined in as Genesis. He divided the light from the darkness. He divided the dry land from the wet sea. The point that the commentators made is that the dark was the dark and the light was the light. The dry was the dry and the wet was the wet. When you obtain a certain status and licensed as a certain person, you have privileges and responsibilities. As a physician, I was granted the privileges and the responsibilities thereof. And if I was going to take care of my responsibilities, I had to use my privileges. If I was going to exercise my privileges, they were to be involved in the responsibilities that I was delineated. The Ten Commandments are delineations of privileges and responsibilities. When I take another man's wife, if a wife takes another man's husband, that is taking privileges that aren't yours. when I don't honor my father and mother, that's not exercising the responsibilities that are mine. I can know I can be happy, I know I can be just, when in my station, whether it's frog, prince, eagle, goat, whatever, I have privileges and responsibilities to address. And I can address my expectations and realities based on what I perceive are my privileges and responsibilities thereof. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. In fact, you know, in a legal sense, it's always treated as the after effect for having violated the law and the determination through judgment as to what is going to be deemed an appropriate punishment. So you're already dealing with a couple of illusions right there, because the whole concept of guilt and blame and punishment are enforcing illusions that ultimately deny the fact that we don't live in this state eternally, that we are mortal and that at some point we're going to die. So all of these things mask the various aspects of reality as it's created for us. I would say that justice is that which does not violate universal law, or that which does not violate the truth. And that's all-encompassing.
Well, truth is a constant expansion of our perceptions of reality. I could go back and forth on that a little bit. One of the things I think that you're saying is that laws, you know, I've often asked people, how can there be so many lawyers in this country and yet so little justice? And I come to realize what Paul was trying to tell his Christian brothers, and saying, look, the law has nothing to do with justice. The laws are artificial lines drawn in the sand that some people have tried to say is going to be a way of explaining what could be just, you know, when two people argue over the same issue type of thing. Justice, it's real important for me as a scientist to have clear, concise definitions of things so I can do derivations. I can put equations together, and I can go from A to Z with a nice clean line without dropping things. Now, I can think about your negative. I forget in geometry they have corollaries and all those things, and you've demonstrated kind of a negative. I think the best positive definition of a justice I can think of, in order for people to perceive the expectations and realities correctly, is the one that I would probably have to attribute to Plato and to the commentators of the Torah, where it's basically exercising your privileges and your responsibility within your delineated sphere of influence. If I'm an attorney, I don't try to practice law. If I'm I don't try to practice medicine. If I'm a physician, I don't try to practice law. I understand the privileges and responsibilities within my sphere of influence, and I leave it there. You know, in 10 years of an emergency room, I never had a malpractice suit because I understood my limitations. If the patient had a problem that I didn't understand, say, you know, Don, I'm sorry, I don't understand the situation. I'll try to get you with a physician. Or, you know what, I don't feel comfortable sending you home tonight because I don't know if you'd be completely stable. I want you to stay here tonight until I can get you a physician.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I had to be honest with people, because anybody that says they know everything, even in their own specialty, is a liar. We constantly grow. We constantly learn. We constantly advance. And so as long as I exercise my privileges and my responsibility within my sphere of influence, I am in a just situation. And that doesn't mean I can't make mistakes. That's one of the big other examples I give to people in the article on addiction about the story of going to heaven. There's a bowling lane there. and I hypothetically tell them, well, throw the ball down the lane. We're in heaven for eternity. Is it going to be a strike every time? Just doesn't mean perfect. It is.
Well, I understand that. In my definition, and, you know, I'm taking, you know, we have, you know, we're living on a prison planet. So there are those that administer justice to others, okay? Mm-hmm. And they've created some 23 million laws to pull that off. Mm-hmm. And all the while they're doing that, they're ignoring the 10 laws that God gave us. Okay?
Yeah.
So I'm looking at myself as a sovereign being created by God and maintaining my sovereignty. The responsibility that you speak of, and that's a topic I speak of often on this show, is that we must take responsibility not just for what we do, but what we allow others to do that keeps us from realizing who we truly are. Ultimately, everything leads to truth. And this may be too philosophical for this for this show or this conversation, because we're talking about addictions. But in my sense, I'm reaching for the highest. What can be higher than knowing all that there is to know? Not in an ego sense, but to be part of that experience, if you get my meaning, to know God.
Exactly. Well,
that's what I'm talking about.
And the only addendum I would put in there is, remember, Don, you got eternity to do that. And if you learn it all tomorrow, you're going to be bored for the rest of eternity.
Oh, yeah, I never put a time limit on it. But I also think that pretending that that's something that I'm going to do some other time, that I'm going to procrastinate, is the biggest mistake we can make. Because as long as we're procrastinating in that effort, we are not moving towards that goal. We are stagnant, or we're moving backwards.
When Martin Luther King Jr. was challenged as to why, or how do you reconcile passive civil disobedience with civil disobedience, with an active civil disobedience? Now, whether he quoted Buddha, the story goes that he quoted Buddha, and Buddha never wrote anything, so we don't know if this was actually attributed to Buddha or not. But I use the term, it's a frequently used term. When you're confronted with an unjust, what you perceive as an unjust reality according to your expectations, you compare reality and your expectations, and you find out that reality is unjust or wrong. You not only have a right to address reality, you have an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying, what I hear you saying, is that, you know, Rich, I feel that you can't just sit and you know what, Don, you're right, because you're not exercising your privileges. If you come to me and I see that you have a certain disease, I have responsibility to exercise my privileges. I have responsibility to go ahead and say, no, we have to do something about this. And people that just sit on the sidelines, that just, you know, say, well, I'm not doing anything illegal. Well, you know what? It is unjust, because they're not exercising their responsibility. They're not exercising their privileges, are they?
Well, actually, they're depending on everyone else to do it for them.
Yeah.
Which,
I
call that spiritual welfare.
Yeah, In medicine, which I relate to more, you have misfeasance and malfeasance. Malfeasance is when you do something wrong. Misfeasance is when you miss something. Okay? So in their life, they're missing a lot of things, and it's just as, and it can be just as, liable and just as punishing, and you know, Jesus talks about that to the people that were given certain talents, and they sat on it, and the other guys were working their tails off, and you know, yeah, justice means not just your responsibilities, but exercising your privileges and moving forward and growing and addressing reality and addressing your expectations. And sometimes, you know, this comes to the golden point. Boy, we've hit this timing perfect. Because the next question is, well, what do I do when I see that reality is wrong and my expectations are right? But the question is, how do I address it? And let's go back to the story again of the princess that kisses the frog. She could have lied. She could have said, well, it was the right thing to do. It's humility which reconciles perfection with imperfection. There's a reason why the same three issues keep coming up through certain literature like Judeo-Christian literature. Do justly, love mercy, walk humbly. The prayer of serenity is, God grant me the wisdom to change the things I can, to accept the things I cannot, and the wisdom to know the difference. The wisdom is humility. You remember the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Well, that's humility.
Mm-hmm.
When we're able to be humble, acknowledge the fact that we are a frog, or again, that you don't like that particular analogy, but the point is that I'm not a prince. And you know what? Don's not a prince either. And if Don makes a mistake, you know what? So what? I make mistakes too. We're getting through this thing called life together. And
oh, yeah. We have to be able to forgive ourselves for making mistakes and allow ourselves to make them, but not make them out of ignorance or will or out of denial.
And even if we do, you know what? I've done it. And
mm-hmm.
you have, and everybody else has. And the whole perfection thing, that's Lucifer's laws. He was a liar. When Jesus told the Jews, which he was telling us to our face, your father is Lucifer. He's a liar. He's been a liar from the beginning. You're not perfect. You have to be humble. You have to be merciful. And yes, you still have to do the best you can. You're supposed to do the best you can. You're supposed to strive to do the best you can. But you know what? We meet challenges. And sometimes the challenge isn't between good and evil. Sometimes it's between evil and less evil. That is the way this whole yin-yang challenging experience is made to be. If it's going to have challenges, it's made to have potential failures. And when you judge people as though you're perfect, you're a liar. And when you try to act as though you're perfect, you're a liar.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is, yes, we all try to address our privileges and responsibilities right. We hope that everybody else will do the same, but you know we don't. And the greatest story that Jesus said is, you know what? That's life. And if you're just humble enough to be patient with everybody else enough, you'll realize that's life. Like you said, we weren't made to live perfectly. And we weren't made to live forever. We were made to get up and go and stumble and fall and get up and go further. And yeah, we'll stumble and fall and get up and go and stumble and fall. And that's what we do. This is who we are.
Yeah, I've had people ask me, why do you hate so-and-so, or why do you hate these people? And I'm quick to counter with, I don't hate these people. I hate what they do, or what they don't do. I hate when they don't take responsibility for their actions.
Not exercising their responsibilities. It's frustrating. We all live with it. We, unfortunately, people have had to live with a lot of times when I acted unjustly, when I didn't address my responsibilities or privileges, when I caused other people grief and, you know, what God sent to me, a lot of grief. And the only thing I can think of is that, you know what, I'll praise God from the depths of hell. And I've learned to be a much more patient and understanding and humble man for
mm-hmm.
what's happened to me. And realize that, you know what, we're all frogs.
We're all princes dressed up in Halloween costumes like frogs.
both, I guess. But one of the things I've learned when I was standing in a tarmac, chained and shackled, and people in their planes were looking at me, and I had FBI agents in assault garb and weapons and everything, I realized the value of the frog, the intrinsic value and worth of the frog. My most fond memories of professors in medical school were, certainly were smart, but they were also very patient and kind and gracious to take time to answer questions that I might have, regardless of how intelligent or how stupid the question was. The heroes are not just super gifted beings. They're also human beings which have shown their humanness. That's the people that we really like to see as humans or as heroes that we can relate to and realize that, you know, that Superman is also Clark Kent. Does that mm-hmm. sort of make sense?
Yeah. When I listen to your story, which in our closing moments here, and I think about the injustice that was done to you, presuming that I'm hearing the truth, and I have to say from the documents I've read and the transcripts I've read, and your model of addiction and the overall scenario of what's going on, not just in your case, but how it ties into everything else I have studied and researched and talked about with guests and listeners on this show, even in the monologues I've done, I see a pattern that is so controlling, so out of control at the same time. It's controlling the people, and it's absolutely out of control. And so the people who are affected by that are out of control. We've got lots of problems that we have to resolve. And I'm sort of taking the totality of humanity into perspective here, in that we're either going to destroy ourselves or we're going to rise above this and wake up from this nightmare that we're in. It's not a dream state. It's a nightmare.
I think humility is the answer, Don. I think when we have, all of us strive to do good things. We all fail. We need to be forgiving. I think if we're going to get through this thing, to all this 2012 stuff and all these extraterrestrial forces and everything else that everybody's starting to discover, you know what? I think they have the same issues. I think they go through the exact same questions because they're going through this thing called life, regardless of wherever it is. And I think it comes down to the same thing. They have to understand that it's about humility. It's about forgiving. And,
Have you written an addiction model for reptilians?
I think it's the same thing. I really do. I think it doesn't matter what level you're on, because why was the last example of Jesus to his disciples to wash their feet before he gave his ultimate sacrifice? If you think that's a coincidence, I hope that you consider that a little bit more. Everybody needs order. Everybody needs truth. Everybody needs justice, whether you're in a Luciferian paradigm or a Jesus paradigm. The difference is, in the Luciferian pyramid, the eye's at the top. In Jesus' model, you take care of everybody below you. Think about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I don't have any misconceptions about that. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
I've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed this time with you, Don, and I appreciate talking with you and learning from you. And you've got a very interesting sight, and I hope you continue to do good things and help us understand all the ins and outs of these politicians.
Well, it's just it's my effort, and you know, this is you know, the truth comes to everybody in a different way, if it ever gets there at all. And I guess it's always staring us in the face. I think if we take the blinders off and take the earplugs out of our ears and open our hearts and allow the wisdom, as you referred to it, and the knowledge, and set belief aside for the moment. If we're going to believe in something, let's believe in something that's real, and not in illusions. I prefer ultimately belief if it's moving in a forward or an upward path, a vertical path, is going to lead you to the truth eventually. And once you get to knowledge, belief no longer serves a purpose.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
And I think our salvation to some extent lies there as well. I think that we have a responsibility to know things rather than to assume that they're a certain way, because we're assuming that this is a reality that we're living in. It's been created for us, and it has nothing to do with our true nature. Ultimately, all these things that we've talked about, this corruption and addictions and all that, are really a reflection of the illusion that we're trapped in. These drugs keep us, even though they may have some merit in subduing pain, or at least dulling the pain receptors of the body, the side effects and the downside of the obsessive compulsive disorder and the addiction is too big of a price to pay for the momentary relief that one might get. Not to mention the financial expense and what will cause people to do anything outside of rational judgment or rational decision making in adherence to universal law or to God's laws, in other words. So, you know, we move into areas of crime and doing things to other people that we normally would not do.
I
think the people that are manufacturing these drugs bear a tremendous responsibility karmically for what they're doing to people who are trusting that they're getting truthful information about the purpose of these drugs and what they will do for them. Not to mention the Trojans that are involved. The issues, the health issues that arise later on, sometimes years later.
I think the politicians that have diverted the money bear an enormous responsibility and for what they've done. If you look at this, the pharmaceutical companies actually paid the price, and the politicians stole this money to feed their campaigns and their quest for control and power.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a vicious circle, isn't it?
It's a very terrible tragedy, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you for being on the show. We're out of time. I'd like to have you back if you would come back again, and we can
to be on your program.
Take this in another level. Do you have a closing, parting message you would like to leave with the listening audience?
Sure. Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly.
Okay. Well, it's that bewitching hour when we have to get our princely sleep so we don't wake up looking like frogs.
I agree. I appreciate it, and I've enjoyed this. And I wish you and your audience the best.
Well, okay, and I wish you the best of luck. We'll keep praying that you get a just resolution, speaking about justice. In your case, I know that the settlement is the issue that's pending, and then the side issues that
if it never happens, we've had this opportunity to share this with your audience, and it's happening. It didn't happen the way I expected it or wanted it to. But you know what? If these rascals want to steal all that money, so what? We'll put out the truth, and I'm just as proud of that as anything.
Well, just so we arrive at some solutions. I trust that someone got something valuable out of tonight's interview.
Well, so I hope they did. I always enjoyed listening to you. I get something valuable from it.
Well, I thank you. Well, I'm going to wish you a good night, and we'll be in touch about having you on. again soon, hopefully. This is not something that should sit, you know, by the wayside. This is important because people are dealing with these issues, and no one called in. That means they're listening.
Yeah.
So
or sleeping, and maybe they need to do that too. That's okay. So they can get the archive on it tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I wish you good night, Rich, and I'm going to say good night to the listening audience. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. And tonight's guest, Dr. Richard Norton, will be back with us again soon. Special thanks to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible and for Seth on the sound. In the meantime, I wish the listening audience peace, love, and light, and have a good night.